Might open up your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 17, and we'll look there in just a moment. 2 Kings chapter 17. It's good to see each and every one, and we are thankful for the presence of all of our visitors. We looked last week, as was mentioned a moment ago, at Isaiah and his call, and so opening up really the book of Isaiah. But I want to pull away from that for just a moment and come back to it. I want to look at all the things that Isaiah has to say. He covers so much territory with regards to all the things that he has to say to the other nations, to the northern kingdom that we're going to look at this morning, and but most of all to the southern kingdom and to what's coming if they do not change their ways. And then, of course, the messianic things that he had to say, some of which we looked at this morning. So we'll return to that very soon, but I want to break away to look back to the northern kingdom, because Isaiah prophesies through the end of the northern kingdom. And so we're going to look at the 2 Kings account of that ending of the kingdom. It's brief in its account. It tells us just that it did end, that they were taken away into Assyria, and then tells us some of the reasons that that happened. We looked at the prophets Jonah and Amos and Hosea, and those prophets prophesying during the high point of the northern kingdom's career, you might say, with Jeroboam II being on the throne at that time and financial success and power at that time. After the Jeroboam II, you have the last of the descendants that was promised to Jehu, and then things go downhill very quickly. And in fact, we're not going to, at least as we're going through the Bible right now in our sermons, we're not going to spend time on all of the things that happened, the few things that we're told about in that brief period of time. But it just so quickly wraps up. It's like that was the last opportunity. And the prophets are making that case right there. Things are still good. They could stay good, but they don't. And so things go down very quickly. And it resolves here in 2 Kings chapter 17, as I say, just briefly telling us, and that was the end of Israel. And that's about it. I mean, it doesn't go on this long, protracted history. You don't have, something like the decline and fall of the Roman Empire where you have pages and pages and pages. It just went down. And they were destroyed. They were taken away into captivity. But what I want to do particularly is look at the reasons that are given. I think, in fact, more time is spent in this text telling us about the reasons they fell than exactly how they fell. We really don't care, do we? We don't care about the military aspects, how it was that Assyria invaded and what process they used to bring them under subjection. What we care about is how this happened and spiritually how that applies to us. And so we're going to begin looking at that in verse 6 and go through verse 18 at some of the things that the historian tells us about that. 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria, captured Samaria and carried Israel away into exile to Assyria and settled them in Halah and Haber on the river of Gozan in the city of the Medes. Well, there it is. That's the fall, right? And then the rest, as you continue reading, is going to be the reasons. Let's look at that, beginning in verse 17. Now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And they had feared other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and the customs of the kings of Israel which they had introduced. The sons of Israel did things secretly, which were not right against the Lord their God. Moreover, they built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set for themselves sacred pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burned incense on all the high places as the nations did, which the Lord had carried away to exile before them. And they did evil things, provoking the Lord. They served idols, concerning which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this thing." Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments, my statutes, according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you through my servants, the prophets." However, they did not listen, but stiffened their neck like their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They rejected his statutes and his covenant which he made with their fathers and his warning his warnings with which he warned them, and they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the nations which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to do like them. They forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves molten images, even two calves, and made an Asherah, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. Then they made their sons and their daughters pass through the fire, and practiced divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. And so for the rest of the book of 2 Kings, for the rest of the Chronicles account after this, then our focus, of course, is on Judah, who will, unfortunately, in so many ways, follow the same path. What is that path? What does it look like? Well, let's notice a few things. As the apostasy is beginning to be described, you go back to the beginning there in verse 7, as he starts to tell us how they got away from what they were supposed to be doing. The first thing that he says there is this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them from the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So the first thing is that they have forgotten who God is, what he has done for them, and they have ingratitude and forgetfulness, which incidentally so often go hand in hand. I mean, when we forget things, usually it's things we don't care about, and it's an indication that we are not grateful for the thing that we've forgotten. And so God constantly brings up the things that he's done, and particularly, incidentally, as you're looking through the history, as you look through the prophets, God will over and over go back to this right here. Don't you know how you started? Don't you know that I brought you from the land of Egypt? And can I suggest to you, every departure from God is a combination of ingratitude and forgetfulness. That people forget true things, they forget the great things that God has done, they forget what their relation to him is based on, what it is founded on, and they begin to drift because they have failed to continue to remind themselves of those things. And that has certainly been the case with the children of Israel from the very beginning, is that they have forgotten those things. And I want to suggest to you that I think in any people's current history, as we are currently living out history right now, we do not recognize the potential for human forgetfulness. We don't realize how easy it is to forget things. There are things that we think that could never pass from our minds, could never, and what's worse, pass from our children's minds. We don't recognize how much is necessary in order to keep things at the forefront of our minds, whether it's our minds or our children's. I think the danger is greater with our children because we think if it's here, it must be there. Like by osmosis, by being around us, they're going to pick up what's in here, so ingrained in here. They're not. If you don't say it and say it again and again and again, they will lose it. And what's more, so will you. And you think people could never forget the fundamental things. Can you imagine being one of the people who literally saw the waters of the Red Sea part and walk across on dry land, and having come to the land of Canaan and seen not only that, but seen God turn bitter water sweet, rain down food from heaven, destroy an army in the face of this invading force of the Amalekites, and all you are is a group of slaves, and as long as Moses holds his hand up, you defeat him. And then coming down to Mount Sinai and seeing the mountain shake and the voice of God booming from heaven delivering the law, and then coming and forgetting all of that in the face of the land of Canaan. They did. They forgot it. They forgot it. 40 years later, there's a woman in Canaan who hasn't forgotten it, but they did. And Rahab is still talking about what happened when they were delivered from Egypt. But they've forgotten. It can happen. I think too, as we look at history, certainly as secular people look at history, what they think about the creation story in the Bible and about the story of the flood in the Bible is that those are tales that evolved, that came from nothing, that they sort of developed over time. And they say everybody's got a creation story. What I want to suggest to you is very obvious from evidence, from historical evidence, from cultural evidence, is that those creation stories, those are evidence of people forgetting the original story. There's what's happened. How could people who were in the flood forget it? Who descended from people who came from the flood? Don't you think that information would have been passed down and would have been, you know, that people would never forget about that? And so we look across the culture and we say, for instance, I was having a conversation with one of the girls in Fiji, and she was like, what about these cultures who've never, I mean, in their whole history, they've never heard of God? And I said, no, that's not true. It's not true that in their whole history, they've never heard of God. You go look at the very language of the Chinese people. Brother Freed has some material on this. The stories of creation and the flood are right there. The evidence of it is there. They once knew this. You look at the continent of Africa. There's these manuscripts, thousands of Coptic manuscripts where the Bible was translated into the language of the Ethiopians. And you've got a continent of people who've forgotten all about it. Can I say that we are headed the direction where this continent will be a people who have forgotten all about it? As I was talking to this girl from Fiji, I said, one day we may need some of you people to come preach to America. Because we're headed down the same path that so many other peoples have. Oh no, we could never, because of the foundations from where we started, there's no way we could drift so far as that. The whole world has. It always has. And it will continue to do so. And we've got to have a mentality of recognizing it can happen in any place, in any generation, that departure can happen. That's why we constantly bring back the reminders. It's why we constantly say the same things over and over and over again, like Peter, who says, I want you to be able to remember these things when I'm gone. And we don't want those things to just sort of drift away. We don't want it to be possible that a generation could arise right here that doesn't know God. It could happen. It could happen. All we have to do is say we've heard enough of this particular thing and stop saying it. And it'll be gone. It is interesting to me that Paul, and I think this can't be emphasized enough, Paul points to that forgetful ingratitude in Romans chapter 1 as he begins to talk about the departure of the Gentiles. He says at the very beginning of that discourse, and starting in verse 18, right at the outset of his argument, he says, what happened? They became unthankful, or they became ungrateful. And so what did they do? They forgot God. And they supplied something else in its place. It is a process that can be seen all around us. And so for us, maybe we don't realize the fundamental importance of gratitude. And we don't realize how that can be the very genesis of an apostasy that is so great as this. We're talking about the Catholic Church this morning in our Bible class, and we look at how far they go, and we think, I don't see how anybody could get that far. I'll tell you what, no matter what the departure is, it starts very small. It starts with forgetting a few minor details, a few things that don't seem so important. And then it grows till people forget that this God is the one who brought them out of Egypt. And so we need to be very careful that we do not fall into that same very well-established pattern of forgetfulness and ingratitude. Well, then next, look at the sources of their idolatry. Let's see, he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Was their idolatry there? Yes. Yeah, it seems that they were even, there are indications in several places, they were even participating in that idolatry. So they've come out of idolatry. Then where do they go? They go to Canaan. Is there idolatry there? Yeah. It's all sorts of idolatry there. And so they partake in that. But then he goes on and he says, not only is there idolatry there and in Canaan, the land which I drove out before you, for the people I drove out before you, but then also your own kings. And so it's all around them. It's in the culture around them. It's even in their own culture, their own leadership. And so there are all kinds of pressures. The default will be that you just fall into idolatry. If you just kind of go with the flow, if you just do what everybody else is doing, idolatry is going to be the order of the day. And let me say, nothing's changed. If you go with the flow, idolatry will still be the order of the day. You will still worship things other than God. because most people are not worshiping God. And it will be, certainly, it'll be in the world around us. It'll be in the world that is even not so near to us, but the culture, maybe at a little farther distance. And it'll even be among our brethren. That there is idolatry, that there are people who put other things before God. And if you just sort of compare yourself and go along, sort of try to get along in some way with the rest of the world around about you, you're going to fall into the same trap as these people. You're going to put something before God. But what does God say about that? What does He indicate in this passage? Does He say, well, look, I tell you what, it's the pressures that you must be under, I don't expect you to be able to resist that. I mean, obviously there's so much, not only peer pressure, but it's even to the point of, if it's your leaders, then we're talking about your freedom is at stake here. And so obviously it's understandable that you would go after these other gods. That's not what God says. He expects His people to resist all of this pressure at every turn, all along the way. And at no point does God ever make an excuse and say, well, it's understandable why you would have fallen into this because of everything around you. But what do we say? Well, we say with regards to some of our young people who begin to drift and maybe begin to put other things before God, well, you just don't understand the pressures of today. Well, I try not to get into discussions about which generation's got it worse. I don't know the answer to that. I think the current generation does have a pretty good case. I mean, I think they do have it pretty bad. As far as what young people are seeing and dealing with at earlier and earlier ages. I get all of that. Is it any different? Is it any different from what God's people have dealt with all throughout history? And that those pressures have come and they've been worse at times and they've been less at times. I will say this. I don't know that in some way there's not an advantage to being able to make the stark contrast between what you're doing and what the rest of the world's doing. I think there's some help there and some benefit being able to say that is clearly nothing you should be a part of. But even if the pressures are worse than they've ever been, then we've got to stand up just like these people ought to have and say, no, I have nothing to do with it. And that separation is going to get more and more stark as the world continues. Just as their existence continued, it ought to have become more and more clear that they were nothing like the people around them, as opposed to becoming more and more like the people around them. There ought to have been that clear distinction, that clear separation. Paul talks about that in 2 Corinthians 6. What have you got to do with those people? Well, we want too much to do with them, I'm afraid. And so we've got to separate ourselves, whatever the source is, no matter how universal it seems to be, make the distinction. Well, I tell you, one of the most miserable parts of the story here, and as you look at them and then you look at Judah, is that there's so much indication about what was going to happen. There should have been no shock to these people that this was going to be the end, that the result was going to be their destruction. One of the ways that it shows that is he tells us that they followed the path of the other nations in verse 11 who he carried away into exile before them. So here's these other nations going into exile, you know, Assyria is going and they're gobbling up territories one right after another. And they're watching that. They're watching all of these people who are in the midst of idolatry. Their prophets are telling them, if you'll shun this idolatry, you'll be spared. You know, you won't have to suffer what they suffer. And they continue doing what those other nations are doing and expecting a different result. I suggest to you we do the same thing. Again, we look around and we always think, most people think that when they do something harmful, when they do something detrimental, that they are different. Somehow they will not reap the same rewards as that person over there who has suffered so much. I've had this conversation so many times with young people in particular. I remember talking to a young man. I was talking about the seriousness of his relationship to this young lady. that he was involved with, and as a very young age, and I said, this is not going to end well. There's going to be heartache. There's going to be decisions that you're going to have great regrets over. And he looked at me with an absolutely straight face and said, you just don't know. We are different. Can I tell you that they weren't? Is that a shock to you? They weren't different. And it did end badly, and it did end in heartbreak, and it ended with two people who are actually bitter towards God's people to this day. Because they wouldn't listen to, look at all these other people who are making the same decisions that, made the same decisions that you're making now, look where they ended up. Oh, we won't end up there. Listen to what God's Word says. And when you see other people falling to the very consequences that God's Word warns of, it should solidify that. It should say, well, there it is. And it should cause you to back away. But too often, people follow this same path. They say, nope, not me. I'll be different. Another thing about their apostasy is it says they hid their misdeeds. They did them in secret, it says. I don't know what all that means. I don't know to what all it refers. But I do know this. I know a pattern of apostasy is that people hide what they're doing. And what that indicates to me so very often is that they know what they're doing is wrong. Or at least they don't think it's wrong, but they know that other people will think that what they're doing is wrong. Now, here's one thing I see about the gospel. The gospel is never a thing conducted in secret. You see, it's the light. In John chapter 1, it's the light. It exposes things. It gets things out in the open. We should never be afraid to talk about what we believe. And if you are talking to someone and they are worried about what they're saying being broadcast and being talked about in front of other people, hey, light bulb, wait a minute. People who have the truth are not afraid to be out in the open. People who have the truth are not afraid to talk openly about what it is they practice and what it is that they believe. But people who are going a different direction, well, they're very worried about that. And they put a cloak, whether it's through the words that they use, they veil their language about what they're doing, or maybe literally they just try to do it where people don't see what they're doing, or say something where people can't hear what they're saying. And so we need to be very careful about an attitude. And if we find in ourselves a desire to keep secret something that we're doing, that ought to be a warning sign. It ought to say something to us. There's a problem here. Because there is boldness in truth. There is boldness in saying, what I am doing is God's truth. And I want the light to expose it. I want it to be out there in the open. This is a warning sign. Well, then the outcome is that it goes to universal departure. Again, departures are never stagnant. And we'll see this further as we go farther into the story, and we see they reject the apostles. But it says that they began not to just offer these sacrifices. Maybe at first what they did was partial. They did a little bit, they involved themselves somewhat in idolatry. They started with the two calves, but then what? They built on high places and just every place, the towns and the watchtowers, every green place. They found some way to turn every aspect of their lives into idolatry. And that's the nature of something else that you put in front of God. Whatever is most important to you, it's going to find a way into every aspect of your life. It's going to take over. And that's what it did with the children of Israel. It did not stay just a hobby. You see, that's what some people might say about something they ought not to be involved in. Look, that's not the most important to me. And then it begins to take over and it creeps in and it gets a greater and greater hold of your life until it owns you. And it certainly did these people. We'll see how far they went in just a moment. But I want to break away from their apostasy for just a moment and look at God's response. His response, it says, however, here's what they've done. They've made God angry. And let me just say, that is the consistent response of God to sin always. the world does not talk enough about God's anger. It does not talk enough about God's wrath. That's indicated in the notion. You see what people say when even somebody from a denominational perspective comes in and says even something about God's wrath. The song that is in some of our song books, In Christ Alone, is written by a Calvinist. In fact, written by a Calvinist in order to sort of teach some aspects of Calvinism. But some of which we agree with and some of which we don't. But one of the things that it says there, it says the wrath of God was satisfied. And a number of churches said, well now hold on, denominational churches, said, we really like your song. I mean, we're all about the In Christ Alone part. But that whole notion of God's wrath being satisfied, that we don't talk about God's wrath. Well, then why change? I think we've gone off the rails a bit in talking about universal or unconditional love. I read a lot of parenting books and it talks about unconditional love. And the indication at the end for some of those, not all of them, but for some of those is that universal or unconditional love means that you can never be angry with your children. We're going to see in just a moment, God's anger is not incompatible with His love. But He is very angry at this. As well He should be. And He has an absolute right to destroy the people. At the very first sin that they commit. You go all the way back to Exodus chapter 32 and you see that's exactly the first thing that He suggests. I'm going to wipe them out. I'm just going to destroy them. And let me just say, He'd have been right to do so. And it is His mercy that causes Him not to. And that gives them another opportunity, just as we're going to see here. But God's anger, if God's anger is not there, then His love, just like we talked about, if His holiness, if we don't understand His holiness, then you can't understand His love. If you don't understand God's anger, you can't understand His love. It's meaningless. Because He can't do anything else but love, apparently. But His anger, His righteous anger, shows how much He loves us when He does give opportunity. So He does give opportunity. He pleads with them. And He sends, it says, He warned Israel and Judah through all His prophets and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways. Keep my commandments. Again and again, He appeals to them. Come back to me. We talked about that with Hosea and the very emotional appeal there of a husband to an unfaithful wife to come back. And he woos her and tries to get her to come back. And this image is one that should be impressive, and it's one that should break the heart of someone who has been unfaithful to God. Here is someone who has every right to put you away, but has said, come back to me. And I want to say there is where we recognize how great God's love is. When in the midst of the anger, He says, come back to me. Doesn't mean He's not angry. You know, when He says come back, it doesn't mean that He's not still wrathful. But He's saying, I still love you. And I still want you to come back to me. I think again, going back to the misunderstanding, you know, sometimes I would say to my parents, I don't want you to be angry with me. Well, that possibility flew out the door when you did this. We are angry. But we don't have to stay angry. You see, that's where God's love is. I don't have to stay angry. He'd be justified to stay angry. But he doesn't have to stay angry. And He tells us what to do to keep Him from staying angry. And that is what shows a love. That's what shows an unconditional love. I still love you, as we've said before, because you're still alive. Because I could have destroyed you by now. And so, His love is most illustrated when our sin is most clearly recognized. That's no different than today either, is it? That's what God, or rather Paul, lays out there by God's direction, of course, in the book of Romans. He talks about the great sin. He says, but with the increase of sin, God's grace increased. And so again, Can you recognize God's love without recognizing your sin? You certainly won't appreciate it like you should. And so God appeals to them. We have less excuse than these people had. Because they had the prophets up to that point. We've got even more prophets. We don't only have more prophets, but we've got the completed revelation. We've got the whole picture. So here are people who were expected to return based on limited information. We have the full revelation of God. And so here, these words could be said to us, I have appealed to you, but I have sent one after another, and these seers and these prophets, and I have told you to come back. And so we are with even less excuse than they are. Well, then we see the response, once again, of Israel to those pleas. They grew more rebellious in the face of the extended love that God showed to them. However, it says they did not listen. They stiffened their neck. They stiffened their neck like their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. They rejected His statutes and His covenant, which He made with their fathers, and His warning with which He warned them. That idea of stiffening the neck, when we preach God's truth, and there are people who are not softened by it, very often it produces the opposite effect. It either brings people closer or it drives them farther away. This is the paradox of the gospel, but it is also the heartbreak of it. You go to preach to people, and obviously the thing that you want is to bring them closer, and it drives them farther away, and you feel like, well, maybe I could settle for a middle ground, just keep my mouth shut. Because I'd rather them be maybe right here than driven farther away. God says, no, I want you either closer or farther. Lukewarm, I'll spit you out of my mouth. I don't want that. I want people to have an opinion about God. You know, that's where we're drifting to today, is this sort of let bygones be bygones, and there are some people who don't believe in God and some people do. Let's just kind of leave it. No, we're going to have to keep either bringing people to us or driving wedges. And we can't sort of stay in that middle ground. The prophets weren't allowed to sort of say, you know what? I'm going to kind of hope that you don't go farther. I'm just going to try to keep you at where you are. No, they're going to preach that message. It's either going to cause people to respond or cause people to become stiff-necked and drive them farther away. They followed vanity, and it says they became vain. We say sometimes we are what we eat, and there is some truth to that. But there is far more truth to we are what we worship. We become more and more like whatever it is that we worship. And people who worship what is vain become vain people. And you don't have to wonder about that. You don't have to say, well, I'm not sure if we can see that. Just go talk to anybody who has made pop culture their idol. Who has made the vanity of pop culture, the emptiness of pop culture as the thing that they aspire to and that they worship. And they are people who are wrapped up, they are saturated with nothingness. But of course, people who worship God become more like God. And so we've got to ask ourselves, what are we becoming more like? What direction are we going? And maybe that will give us some information about what it is that we worship. Sometimes we might say, well, I worship God. Are you becoming more like God? Well, what is it that you're worshiping? Truly, what is it that's most important to you? What do you put first in your life? These people became what they worshiped. Not only that, but their transgressions grew worse and worse. And it builds up to the point where it says they're throwing their children. You talk about incremental moving towards a state that rational people would say is insanity. These people have babies, and they bring those babies up to an idol that has a fire burning inside of it, and they stick their live babies into a hole to bake them to death. You say, how could anybody get there? Look around you, people.
We got people playing with baby parts on a table and laughing about it. Anybody can get there. All you've got to do is just start walking down that path, one foot after the other. You make small incremental departures, and eventually you find yourself doing things like this, going so far to where they are described. It says they have sold themselves. They sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking Him. They're slaves. And you don't have to go as far as all that to become a slave, but that is the idea, that you can't even see reality anymore. You're so enslaved that you cannot see up and down anymore. And we have a whole world around us that is so bought and sold into this that they cannot see reality. We've been having conversations. We were talking yesterday about, you know, gender dysphoria. Is that what they call it? You know, people who don't have a clue about basic biological realities, saying they're the party of science, incidentally, and don't have a clue about basic biological truths, and they say they're the ones that are free. They have sold themselves to where they are blinded to reality, and they cannot allow themselves to see truth. They're tied to their doctrines. They are tied and chained to the things that they practice. And now God's messengers are coming with swords. They're coming with weapons. It is the Assyrians who are God's messengers. And so it will be with us. You know, people think that what we're doing is hard when we preach the truth. And they're saying, you know, that's harsh. That's uncaring. It's unloving. Unloving to try to keep you from this? What a miserable thing it must have been as the people are walking away into slavery, into total domination of the Assyrian Empire, looking back and remembering all the words that had been preached to them and thinking, wow, I wish we'd have listened. Somebody, I was talking about in one of the sermons on Calvinism, one of the Calvinists I read said, well, if you believe that about one of the doctrines, then what you're saying is that there are people who are going to go to hell who didn't have to go there. That's the worst part about hell, isn't it? Is to hear that and realize you didn't have to go there. This isn't just the course of history. This is not just one brutal nation taking over another nation and just, you know, the events playing out. This is avoidable. And so our destruction, God's warnings will reach this climax, and there will be people who realize that they should have listened. And so, what about you this morning? Would you heed those warnings? That's why they're there. You know that's why that's written, right? I mean, that's God's not just saying, you know what? I want to make sure I'm a good historian. Because frankly, as far as historical works go, it's not really comprehensive or very helpful in figuring out all the details of history. God says, I want you to know what you need to know to avoid the mistakes of the past. Which is, incidentally, the most important part of studying history. Don't do what these people did. Part of that, though, is recognizing that you can. Is recognizing that you could follow that same path. That those people that you think are so crazy could be you. If you find yourself putting something else before God. If you find yourself forgetting about what your relationship to God is founded on. Any of those sorts of things. And so you think, I'm nothing like those people. Those people were nothing like those people when they started out. And so if you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, well, I'll tell you what, you are. Every time that you walk out of this building knowing what you ought to do to become a Christian and do not do it, you have just hardened your heart a little bit more, taken one step farther away from God, and made it a little bit more difficult for the next time. And you've drawn closer to these people. If you're here this morning and you need to reconcile yourself before God, every day that goes by and you hear warnings and you hear the gospel call, that's your neck just got a little stiffer. And don't think that you won't end up in the same boat as these people. And don't think that one day that messenger won't come bearing the sword. But you could avoid it. You could avoid it this morning, and if we can help you in any way to do that, won't you come and stand while we sing?